And we are now back with Blacklisted Talk Radio. It's 12:41 in Los Angeles, California, on killradio.org. And here is the old-time radio section of today's program. I think it's going to be very interesting for you. Going back, first off, to the information from December the 14th of 1939. Recordings from the relatively lousy archives, you know, that early of NBC News. They had a habit of recording their a lot of their news material on these paper based transcription discs. You know, they weren't even transcriptions. I think they were mainly Memovox kind of things. Just for reference, just play them two or three times, and by that time, they're done for. And however, December the 14th of 1939, the source on this, by the way, is the Newstalgia page, N-E-W-S-T-A-L-G-I-A, at crooksandliars.com. News for the week of December the 14th, 1939, was concerned mostly with the sea battle going on between the German battleship Admiral Graf Spee and the British Navy outside of Montevideo, Uruguay. The encounter, which eventually cost the German Navy one of their prize ships, was a much-needed victory for Britain and a morale boost in terms of what was going on with the events of what was developing into the Second World War. I think it was still referred to as the European War at that time, even though Canada was involved as well, because, of course, they were still an active part of the British Empire, as were Australia and New Zealand. And there was also the stuff going on in China that Japan was conducting. But in any event, we have some of the reports concerning the Graf Spee from NBC News Archives. And even though the audio might be a little hinky on this, I think it's going to be something that is very fascinating. From December the 14th of 1939.
The National Broadcasting Company brings you from Montevideo, Uruguay, a first-hand account of the sea battle between the German pocket battleship Graf Spee and the British cruisers Achilles, Ajax, and Exeter. For this report, we take you now to Montevideo.
NBC, Montevideo, in Uruguay. The first naval battle of the war fought in South Atlantic waters approximately 6 o'clock yesterday afternoon, just off the coast of Uruguay. Almost in front of a beach, a place called Punta del Este, or East Point, as we would call it, and maneuvers of the ships at battle were quite plain to thousands of persons who were diverting themselves at the time. Also, to the Uruguayan gunboat, which was on a training cruise, patrolling coastal waters in and around Lobo Island, which is not more than 85 or 90 miles from this city. The French liner, Formosa, on her way to Montevideo in Buenos Aires, under convoy of the British cruiser Exeter, which was suddenly surprised by the 10,000-ton German pocket cruiser Graf Spee, which was also on her way north after having sunk two British ships, one of 7,000, the Terror, and one of 5,000 tons, the Springhold, just off the mouth of the Plata River. Leaving her convoy brace, advancing to give battle, the Exeter engaged the Graf Spee, and a running battle ensued for some 4 hours, at which time the British light cruisers, Ajax and Achilles, arrived on the scene from the north and west, respectively, and engaged the Graf Spee from these different angles. It seems that after this first 4 hours battle, the Exeter was hit Just how bad is impossible to say at the moment. However, she was forced to reduce her speed and more or less retire from battle. But as a last resort, put on fourth draft and kept on her firing, as steaming away, and reported to have put out of condition the large 12-inch batteries of the Grass Sea. The small cruisers, Ajax and Achilles, which mount only 6-inch guns, gave up their running position and running fire, and battle raged for some 4 or 5 hours more until the Grass Sea changed her course and put into the port of Montevideo, arriving at approximately at midnight, where she was immediately boarded by the Uruguayan port and government officials, and her captain expressed a desire to see the German ambassador, who later boarded but would make no statement. The Grass Sea, it is definitely known, has suffered at least 30 dead and 60 wounded. One young artillery officer branded by shrapnel. The number of dead and wounded, if any, on the British cruisers is not known due to the fact that neither of these three ships have put into port. The Exeter evidently has continued out to sea, and it is thought that both the Ajax and the Achilles are waiting just off the coast of Uruguay for the final termination of the battle, which will be surely decided when the Grass Sea sails from Montevideo. At which time we will surely have news for you of one of the heaviest naval battles to be fought in South Atlantic waters since 1918. We have just had a gentleman come in here who has been around the Grass Sea in a motorboat this morning. So I'll ask him a few questions. What did you see this morning?
Well, I went around the Grass Sea with a motorboat this morning, and the pocket battleship is lying in the middle of the harbor of Montevideo, and I noticed the following battle scars. On the port side, about 60 feet from the bows, and 5 feet above the waterline, there is a big hole, let's say about 5 or 6 feet in diameter. The steel plates of the armor are torn outward, which made me think at that moment when I saw her that her cannon must have exploded inside the ship. I also noticed that the observation tower right in front of the chimney has been perforated right through. There's a hole on each side of about 1.5 feet in diameter. One of the towers corresponding to one of the small guns, as I should say, a 6-inch gun, has been practically torn off its base. The central tower, the front tower of the 12-inch gun, the only thing I noticed there was the lack of paint and dirt, and I should say, what's left out of the battle, but I never noticed any of those guns, nothing wrong with them. The airplane on the catapult has also been damaged. There's no cloth left in it. It's just the only what the skeleton there is, eh? Sailors are working all over the place, repairing the ship. I believe it's putting on some speed to try to get the boat ready for sea again. You said just a moment, Jim, that the British cruisers are supposed to be lying off the river in front of Montevideo.
Well,
yes. When we flew over from Buenos Aires this morning,
yeah, I never saw any British cruisers.
I had a good look around, I had a good pair of glasses, and there were no British cruisers there at all. Now, as I came through the port after landing the sail, I was told that they're going to bury all the dead this afternoon. I understand that over 30 is going to be buried there. At 5 o'clock.
Yes, I have another night.
Well, that's about all I can tell you, Jim, about it, what I saw.
Well, thanks very much. It seems that at 5 o'clock this afternoon, according to the latest report, the 30 dead of the Grass Sea will be brought ashore to be buried in neutral territory of Montevideo. We've also just received a last-minute report that the Exeter, the Ajax, and the Achilles, the three British cruisers, have been joined by one or two more British cruisers, likely to the north and east of the Uruguayan coast, which looks as though they're going to bottle up the Grass Sea if she tries to leave. And if she does leave, it's a state that she'll be escorted to a safe haven, and where that is, your guess is just as good as mine. Now the Tacoma left Montevideo this morning with 1,600,000 gallons of fuel oil on board. Evidently, she was planning on leaving to turn this fuel oil over to the Grass Sea if it hadn't been for the little fight that came up yesterday.
Yeah, but Jim,
she didn't leave due to the fact that she might run into the difficulties that struck the Usakuma recently that left her.
Right on the side of the Grass Sea, there's a big merchant boat there in camouflage. I understand she's a German, and she arrived in Montevideo Harbor this morning.
Right.
And I've been told, I don't know, maybe a rumor, and that was the boat that was supplying the German, the Grass Sea, all the way through, following the port.
Right.
Now, they lie on one side, on, And there's this change of stuff from one boat to the other.
That's right. For the moment, you think? Well, that's the reason the Tacoma had to leave Montevideo, because she could not transfer the fuel oil in the bay of a neutral port.
Ah, maybe so.
So that's why she had to go outside. She will probably stand outside there and wait for the Grassby to leave and then give her the fuel oil.
Okay. If the Grassby gets out there to get it. Well, this is about all of New York. We can't get any more news. We just arrived a few minutes ago. We hope to give us something further later on. Thank you very much indeed. And this is Montevideo, returning you to New York.
You have heard a report of the sea battle between the German pocket battleship Graf Spee and the British cruisers Ajax, Achilles, and Exeter. The encounter took place off the South American coast, and this report has come from Montevideo, Uruguay. It was heard in the United States via RCA Communications. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
From the 14th of December of 1939, reports on what eventually was the scuttling of the Graf Spee outside of Montevideo, Uruguay. There was, of course, other news at the time of particular interest, especially relating to the European War. The subject being Christmas in Berlin, an estimated 1 million Christmas trees heading for the German capital, and reports of changes in the way that the holiday was being observed with the war going on. Meanwhile, reports came in regarding naval action in the North Sea, and reports the Irish Navy were being supplied with torpedo boats by Britain. News of the conflict in Finland came with reports of Russian air raids on the Finnish capital of Helsinki and clashes between Russian and Finnish troops. And in the Far East, word of Japan's reopening of the Yangtze River to foreign traffic came as some small relief, but the Japanese occupation of China was still a subject of concern. And here we have from the first Christmas season of war in 1939, the news as reported by the Mutual Broadcasting System and their weekly program, Foreign News.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? Good evening. This is Guy Savage speaking to you from Chicago. Every Monday evening at this same time, the Mutual Network brings you a summary of European news compiled by correspondents of the Chicago Tribune and associated newspapers, and sent by wireless and cable from the European capitals by the Tribune's distinguished foreign staff. The Mutual Network thus brings to a nationwide audience a program of European news independently gathered and informatively reported by American correspondents at the scene and free to report that scene as they see it. We present Foreign News. Despite the greatest air and naval activity of the war on the North Sea, and despite Germany's sadness over the loss of the pocket battleship Admiral Graf Spee, 1 million Christmas trees which have arrived in Berlin are having a lively sale, Sigrid Schultz, the chief of the Chicago Tribune's Berlin Bureau, reports. The fears of Germans that would be a treeless Christmas are relieved, Miss Schultz continues, but whether everybody will have enough candles to light up their trees is another question. In Germany, electric lighting of trees is not considered ideal, because it lacks the romantic charm that one associates with the Weihnachtsmann. Women who shop for candles today had to produce their soap ration cards in a number of stores, and the number of candles they bought was inscribed on the cards. The war has affected deeply the traditional Christmas preparations. A person cannot simply study advertisements when preparing for the purchase of presents. The person first must remember various rules and regulations about the distribution of goods of all kinds. One must study and remember what can be bought without special official permits. In the old days, Berlin enjoyed the glitter of lights and the noise of the Christmas fair on the square alongside the old imperial castle. Now all German cities are blacked out and lights are banned. Candy is even rationed. The necktie booths, which once did a thriving business, the hot dog and wafer stands, insist on the presentation of food or clothing cards. To make up for the loss of the traditional fair, Berlin authorities have authorized, or rather organized, a number of small Christmas fairs, which, however, close daily before sundown. toys, Christmas tree decorations, and lace doilies are much in evidence at the fairs. Novelties this year are phosphorescent flowers, animals, initials, and tags of all descriptions. They can be attached to buttonholes to protect the wearer from collisions as they wander through the darkened streets. The Germans and British yesterday gave widely divergent reports of activities on the North Sea. The Germans said their fighting planes shot down 34 of 44 attacking British bombing planes in an aerial battle off the German naval base of Heligoland near the mouth of the River Elbe. The Germans said they lost only two planes. The British asserted that 12 German Messerschmitt fighting planes were shot down and admitted that seven British bombers were unaccounted for. Both sides agreed on one thing. It was the largest aerial engagement of the war. Reporting on other air and naval action, the Germans asserted that their scouting planes had sunk four British steamers and damaged three British warships in a bomb and machine gun raid on a convoy yesterday. Germany was bitter over the scuttling of the pocket battleship Admiral Graf Spee at Montevideo yesterday, and informed sources said it would mark the beginning of new attacks by our fleet against England. That is a direct quotation. It was reported that the Admiral Scheer, sister ship of the Spee, was in the South Atlantic ready to prey on British and French shipping. German official sources declared that Uruguay, under British pressure, broke international law by failing to give the Spee sufficient time to make herself seaworthy. In London, the British expressed great satisfaction over a week's work of their navy, including the engagement in which three British warships disabled the Graf Spee. Winston Churchill, the first Lord of the British Admiralty, declared that the destruction of the raider Admiral Graf Spee was a cause of thankfulness in our islands. He asserted that the peaceful shipping of all nations may now enjoy the freedom of the sea. Churchill said the Spee had the choice to stay in Montevideo Harbor and be interned, or to come out and fight. Then, he said, she discovered a third alternative, to come out and sink herself. Turning to European waters, Churchill said, here at home in the North Sea, our British submarines had the best week I can remember in this or the last war. Only when a German warship is sighted are British submarines able to use their power and skill. The German warships hardly even venture out of port, and then only for furtive dashes. He charged that the Germans now are concentrating on attempting to sink fishing boats. He then praised the work of the British submarine Salmon, which he said last week had blown up a German U-boat, hit a 6,000-ton German cruiser with one torpedo, and another cruiser of equal size with two. He referred to the British submarine Ursula, which today reported the sinking of a 6,000-ton cruiser. Thus, Churchill says, a considerable proportion of the total German cruiser strength has been sunk or put out of action in a single week. Referring to the aerial and submarine warfare in the North Sea, Churchill asserted that, in their wrath, the Germans have been trying to bomb individual unarmed ships moving up and down the east coast of England. Out of 24 ships attacked, only six small boats engaged in fishing and one small coastal vessel were sunk, and the bulk of the others were not even hit by the many bombs cast upon them, he said. These outrages are the tactics of a guilty regime which feels the long arm of sea power laid upon its shoulders. Churchill then told of the landing of the vanguard of the Canadian Expeditionary Force yesterday. He said the leading division of the Canadian Army, strongly escorted across the ocean and guarded by our main battle fleet, disembarked safely and smoothly for a period of intensive training in England before joining their British and French comrades on the Western Front. The troops included a battalion from the eastern provinces and a hospital corps that had traveled 6,000 miles from British Columbia. Among them were 100 or so volunteers from the United States. They were greeted on arrival at Scottish ports by Dominion's Secretary Anthony Eden. A German embassy spokesman in Buenos Aires announced that 1,039 members of the Graf Spee's crew had arrived there from Montevideo and would be interned. The men arrived by tugboats and a barge. Though the sailors will be held, it was indicated the officers will be released on their promise not to participate in the European war. At Montevideo, where the Spee was scuttled and sank in a shallow water yesterday, new explosions rocked the hull, apparently caused by gas that formed in confined spaces from burning fuel oil. Uruguayan gunboats patrolled the vicinity of the wreck. Harold Tatum, the Chicago Tribune's Buenos Aires correspondent, in a dispatch from Montevideo, tells of that city's reaction to the scuttling of the Admiral Graf Spee. A few bits of twisted wreckage and bits of floating debris were all that remained of the Spee, and Montevideo was getting back to normal, Mr. Tatum reported. The British cruiser Achilles, one of the warships which took part in the battle, which disabled the Spey, viewed and photographed the wreckage which extended above the water. The attendance, by the way, at football games yesterday, a favorite South American sport, was the smallest of the season because even Montevideo's most enthusiastic fans preferred to watch the Spey's departure and the subsequent explosion and fire. All conversation dwelt on the end of the pocket battleship and the belief that the battle last Wednesday was a famous engagement that will go down in history. A dispatch from Hugh Curran, the Chicago Tribune's correspondent in Dublin, reports that Ireland soon will have a small fleet of torpedo boats and trawlers for coastal patrols. Neither in numbers nor power will the new vessels be worthy of the title of navy, but they will be of immense value as a mobile adjunct of the coastal watch, Mr. Curran continues. The fleet will include several small, fast torpedo boats carrying two or three torpedoes each, and some boats of the trawler type carrying adequate armament. This development is said to be not the result of the war, but has been contemplated by the Dublin government ever since four principal Irish ports were turned over to the British forces. The vessels were said to be needed because of the government's neutrality policy and the possibility of incidents taking place in territorial waters. Hitherto, the Irish Marine Force consisted of two fishery patrol boats, which have been armed for defense purposes. 20 Soviet-Russian planes today made the first important air raid on Finland since the two-day bombing of Helsingfors and other cities at the start of the Soviet-Finnish War. The raiders bombed two suburbs of Viborg, and air raid alarms were sounded all along the Gulf of Finland. One plane was shot down outside Viborg, but the extent of the damage done by the raiders was not disclosed. On the fighting fronts, the Finnish High Command reported that a total of 36 Russian tanks were destroyed and that a number of attacks were repulsed. The communique said that 26 of the tanks were destroyed on a 12-mile front on the Karelian Isthmus. Norwegian reports said that in northern Finland, a small detachment of Finns using machine guns had killed 700 Russians who were moving en masse along an exposed highway. It was reported that at another place, 300 Russians who were lured onto ground mined by the Finns were destroyed. The Moscow communique declared that Soviet troops had occupied the town of Pitkäjärvi, about 53 miles south of Petsamo in northern Finland. The action on the western front today was confined mainly to scouting activities. The French High Command's morning communique said, a quiet night, some artillery fire. The evening communique said, toward midday, a sharp engagement took place in the Vosges Mountains between one of our reconnoitering parties and German units. We took some prisoners, including two officers. The German High Command's communique said that there was livelier artillery action of both French and Germans between the Moselle River and the forest yesterday, and it added that the German Air Force carried out reconnaissance flights over eastern France. A cable from John McCutcheon Raleigh, a member of the Chicago Tribune Berlin Bureau staff, relates that the monotonous daily repetition in official German war communiques of the phrase reconnoitering activity was clarified somewhat today by a German officer who told that the phrase meant and just what it did mean and how it was applied to the warfare on the Western Front. It is necessary to maintain continuous scouting parties to keep informed of enemy troop movements, the officer said, and to discover whether new units have entered the line, which might indicate reinforcements and an eventual strong attack. There are many reasons for forays in strength, he added. Among them are actions to detonate enemy minefields, capture prisoners, get information for headquarters, and to establish advanced observation posts where the results of artillery fire have been seen more clearly. The officer explained that the equipment the soldiers carry in such raiding parties may vary according to the circumstances. On ordinary raids, the officer said, the men carry wire cutters, heavy leather gloves, potato masher-type hand grenades, light machine guns, extra boxes of ammunition, tools for digging in, and spare rations in case they might be cut off temporarily from their lines. When patrols set out to explode enemy minefields in villages or on rough terrain, they carry batteries and coils of wire. After hooking up an explosive charge, the long strands of wire enable the men to get out of range of the blast. This is done in the hope that such explosions will set off hidden enemy mines. There have been many of these mining parties operating in the no man's land between the French and German lines. As to the kind of camouflage used, the officer said that usually the men remove all insignia from their uniforms to prevent identification of their units if they're captured. They daub mud on their helmets to prevent the reflection of the sun from exposing their positions. Many of the troops, especially trained for scouting purposes, affix branches and leaves to their uniforms and headgear to blend with the landscape, the officer concluded. A Swiss canary gave his life for his country today, a dispatch from E.R. Noder of the Chicago Tribune's correspondent in Bern, Switzerland, reports. The supreme sacrifice was made by the yellow warbler when a skeptical resident of Bern decided that it would be a good idea to test his new gas mask over the kitchen stove. Carefully sealing the kitchen doors and windows, he adjusted the mask over his face, sat in a chair beside the stove, and opened the gas jets. He waited to see just what would happen. He then heard a thud, and peering through the foggy window of his mask, he saw that his wife's favorite canary had fallen from its perch and was lying on the bottom of the cage, its head turned under its wing. Hastily turning off the gas, he threw open the windows and tried to revive the bird, but to no avail. As a result of the incident, Swiss authorities warned the people not to try any kitchen experiments with the masks, which they said are not designed to offer protection from household gas. A dispatch from Kempe Shiba, the Chicago Tribune's correspondent in Tokyo, reports that Foreign Minister Admiral Nomura today informed American Ambassador Joseph Clark Grew that Japan is preparing to reopen the Pearl and Yangtze Rivers to the commerce of foreign powers. The Pearl River in South China is to be opened as far as Canton, and the Yangtze in Central China as far as Nanking. These rivers have been closed for months, the Japanese asserting that other traffic would interfere with their military operations. Nomura also told Grew that Japan would not shut out American economic activities in China. The interview was expected to mark a turning point in Japanese-American relations. All points of the Chinese question were discussed. Sweeping concessions were made by Japan to most of the American demands. You have just heard Foreign News and News Comment, compiled by correspondents of the Chicago Tribune and associated newspapers on duty at the news centers of the European capitals. A regular Monday evening feature presented through the facilities of WGN Chicago. Guy Savage announcing for you. This is the Coast to Coast Network of the Mutual Broadcasting System.
From the 14th or the 15th, could have been either one, actually, of December 1939, program called Foreign News from Mutual, WGN out of Chicago. Now, there was mention made of the changes in the celebration of Christmas in Berlin that particular year with the war going on actively. And here we have something somewhat different. From December the 11th through the 20th of 1945, the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial and the several offshoot trials which were part of it began on November the 20th, 1945, with the initial phase lasting until October the 1st, 1946. In that period of less than a year, the world heard in grim and graphic detail the true nature of horror that was the Nazi regime in Germany. Press coverage was thorough, with both print and radio as well as newsreel reporting on a daily basis, letting the world know on no uncertain terms what was going on. And here is a group of reports from December the 11th through the 20th of 1945. Again, it's broadcast by Mutual Radio as part of its daily recap of the trial from the courthouse in Nuremberg. The report runs a bit grisly in places, so use a bit of caution. Here, from 1945, December 11th through the 20th, radio reports concerning the Nuremberg trials.
This is Arthur Gase in Nuremberg, Germany. Never in the history of mankind have supposedly civilized human beings enslaved their fellow men and dealt with them so brutally as have these Nazis. That has been the brunt of the evidence presented all day today by American Associate Prosecutor Thomas Dobb as he showed from German documents how 4,795,000 foreign civilians and 1,873,000 prisoners of war became work slaves. From Alfred Rosenberg's own trials, Dodd quoted, "We now experience the grotesque picture of having to recruit millions of laborers from the occupied eastern territories after prisoners of war have died of hunger like flies in order to fill the gaps that have been formed within Germany." Now the food question no longer existed. In the prevailing limitless abuse of Slavic humanity, recruiting methods were used which probably had their origin only in the blackest periods of the slave trade, unquote. I can see Simon Legree's fat sulfur sitting down there now. He has had beads of sweat on that shiny bald pate of his most of today. Barbet Spare, who has appeared so innocent-like at this trial, moved around slightly flushed and uneasily today, for as Minister of Armaments and Ammunition, he ordered that prisoners of war were to be employed in armament production, to be taken from camps for that purpose. One of Sulkel's reports actually stated that out of the 5 million foreign workers who arrived in the Reich, not even 200,000 of them came voluntarily. Out of Polish Minister Frank's files, there was this report, quote, "At the beginning, they received half a loaf of bread as daily ration, and later one loaf for 7 persons daily, black coffee at breakfast and supper and soup at dinner time. They never had a day off. They had to work even on Sundays. Terrible frosts were prevalent there, and the lads got no warm clothes. They worked in the clothes they had brought with them," unquote. Sulkel's office issued special regulations for these prisons. To violate them meant transfer to a concentration camp, or if there were some special offense, it meant hanging. The result of all this was decimation of a flower of manhood in all surrounding countries. The most startling revelation came from Dr. Jager of the Krupp Armament Works in Essen, where workers were given 1,000 calories of food a day less than the minimum prescribed for Germans, and where 600 Jewish women were brought from Buchenwald walking in their bare feet. The sole clothing of each consisted of a sack with holes for their arms and head. Their hair was shorn. Jager reported to his superior that the guards lived and slept outside their barracks, as no one could enter them without being attacked by 10, 20, and up to 50 fleas. Doctors refused to enter the camp. After listening to this day of testimony, Uncle Tom's Cabin appears like a fairy tale. However, this story has just begun, and when the evidence on the prosecution of the Jews is presented tomorrow, and the French and Russians tell their story later, every one of these criminals will be tarred black. This is Arthur Gaeth in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.
Today an Irishman, a man named Robert F. Walsh, one of the American associate prosecutors, has been presenting to this court the story of the persecution of the Jews, or as he put it, the endeavor of the Nazis to obliterate the Jewish race. We had been listening all morning to a recital of concentration camp murders. The effort of Prosecutor Dodd was to tell the story of the purpose of the camp, not so much to depict their atrocities, although presented in evidence was a piece of tattooed human skin out of Buchenwald prepared by one Andreas Pfaffenberger, a butcher by trade, before he was employed at Buchenwald. Also presented was a shrunken human head taken from a Polish prisoner who had been beheaded for associating with a German woman. The death books from the camp at Mutthausen were put in evidence, showing 35,318 recorded deaths from the camp in a period of 5 years. Actually, an investigation of the record showed, for example, that in a period of 12 hours in one day, 203 persons died, all listed with the same ailment, heart trouble, and all dying in alphabetical order. The natural conclusion is that these people were executed. From Flossenburg, we had the story that in 1944, a number of prisoners were hanged on Christmas Day, and that the inmates had to attend the hanging, but next to the gallows was a decorated Christmas tree. With that type of evidence, you can imagine that the atmosphere here has been very heavy. On several occasions, there was a deadly stillness among the prisoners. Schacht seems most seriously affected. His face is generally slightly flushed, but as I see him down there now, there's a gray hue over that redness. However, he has had his earphones on and seems to be following the whole proceeding. Seisinkwart, the Austrian, also seems much affected. Now that the persecution of the Jews is being presented, we have been watching Streicher, the Jew baker, a But that yokel who published all that damaging bunk in his weekly, The Stürmer, probably thinks he's the victim of a Jewish plot. He probably doesn't even recognize that Prosecutor Walsh is an Irishman. Placed in evidence were such Stürmer announcements as the Jewish use of human blood in rituals, that the Bible is a criminal romance, etc., etc. As Walsh put it, it's difficult to believe that falsehoods such as these could fall on fertile soil, but with a lying press and complete control of the literature of the country, such doctrine could be fed the German people, and many apparently believed. There is a note of retribution in the report from Dachau. The 40 Nazis tried at that concentration camp were all convicted, 36 to hang, 3 to 10 years, and 1 sentence for life. This is Arthur Gates speaking in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.
This is Arthur Gates in Nuremberg, Germany. After this morning's session of these trials, Goering was heard to say to one of the security staff, and I quote, "We are having an extremely difficult week. It is the type of evidence that we have heard for the past 2 days which brings to light all the brutality of the German program against the Jews, Poles, and others that is bound to bore into these men, hard and callous as they may appear. One of the medical men told me this noon that von Lippentrop, Dönitz, Franz, and Seyss Inquart definitely are showing the effects of this type of testimony. Take this fellow Kaltenbrunner, who was hospitalized on November 18th with a cranial hemorrhage and who has been in court only this week. Outwardly, he appears to be a brute type. His face is scarred with sore glasses, probably from his student days. He has a big frame and is almost 6 feet 4 inches tall. He has a hard, calloused look. Yet he breaks down and cries, and he'll even talk about his Berlin mistress with tears in his eyes. He's the type of fellow that will try every turn of law which he knows to keep from the gallows, but once the situation is hopeless, will probably attempt suicide. Kaltenbrunner's attorney tried a move this morning to force the prosecution to bring German witnesses into court for cross-examination rather than merely permit their affidavits to be read. His thought was that cross-examination might break down an affidavit of the type we heard yesterday when that of the butcher Pfaffenberger was read in corroboration of the exhibit of tattooed human skin which was shown in the courtroom. The tribunal ruled that affidavits are to be admitted, but if their signers are available and the defense petitions, they may be brought into court. This noon we heard the affidavit of a Dr. Wilhelm Hippel, who was a major of the hooted SS. Hippel gave us figures that approximately 4 million Jews were killed in the various extermination camps, while an additional 2 million met death in other ways, the major part of which were shot by operational squads of the security police during the campaign against Russia. You and I find that difficult to believe, but last Sunday I was at St. Ottilien, which is the DP hospital for displaced Jews. Dr. Zelman Greenberg, in charge there, is a Lithuanian Jew who survived Dachau. When the Germans marched into Lithuania in 1941, they ordered all Jews into a ghetto. There were 35,000 of them. On October 28, 1941, the SS leader Rauke ordered 10,800 of those Jews to be taken out and shot. In the next 2 years, 80% of the remaining people were literally worked to death. When the Russians began threatening, the physically able, about 2,000 of those left, were brought first to Tegendorf near Danzig and then to Dachau. Miraculously, about 500 of those people made their escape just before the close of the war. Today, of the Jewish population of 35,000 that lived in Kaunas, Lithuania, in 1941, about 500 people survived. When you talk with one of these people and hear his story, the horror of this whole dastardly Nazi program strikes home. This is Arthur Gates speaking from Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.
This is Arthur Gates in Nuremberg, Germany. In the courtroom today, the prosecution changed a concept some of us might have gotten, that this trial concerns only the 21 men sitting down there. Every one of them is deeply involved in this conspiracy against other peoples of the world. But there are many more Germans also involved who are not sitting down there on those benches. Colonel Robert G. Sperry, one of the American associate prosecutors, today began to bring evidence against what the Germans called the Hoheitsträger, or participators in sovereignty, the 15 Nazi party leaders of the whole Reich, then the leaders of the 41 Gaus or provinces, the leaders of the hundreds of countries or counties, thousands of communities, and tens of thousands of blocks. Actually, this trial today involved about 600,000 Nazis in the conspiracy, and the court is being asked to decide whether they also are guilty not only of conspiracy, but of crimes against humanity and the other charges brought. It is difficult to grasp the implications of all this. Last week, when the military commission handed down the decision at Dachau, it stated that any German involved in the administration of the concentration camp participated in the guilt of those 40 who were being sentenced. That means thousands of others. Personally, I think that is just. But what I ask myself is, who is going to try all these people? It is all right to accuse them, but how are we going to bring them to justice with practically every American, including some involved in this prosecution, straining at the leash to get home, some of them literally running out on their job? If you ask me if we are going to see justice done by all these Germans, I'm prepared to say no. For the majority of the people involved are not concerned enough to see this job through until we have established the guilt or innocence of all the Germans who were involved in producing the tremendous misery that has resulted in Europe. There will have to be a change of heart in many circles unless our attempt to bring Germans to justice is not ultimately turned into a farce. Today, the prima donna of the crowd down there began to hear his name mentioned, Baldur von Schirach, once the leader of the Hitler Jugend, and finally the Gauleiter in Austria, was repeatedly included in the leadership of the party responsible for our troubles. Young and good-looking as the fellow is, and he's only about 34, he develops one of the greatest perversions of young people ever witnessed, and he turned the youngsters of the Reich into a fanatical band of tyrants. As they grew up under the leadership of men like Schirach, they became the fervent followers of the Führer who literally went through hell for him. Today, a startling order from Albert Hofmann, important member of the Nazi leadership corps, was introduced here, and I quote from it. Fighter-bomber pilots who are shot down are not to be protected against the fury of the people. I expect from all police officers that they will refuse to lend their protection to these gangster types. Authorities acting in contradiction to the popular sentiment will have to account to me. End of quote. That throws interesting light on a subject important to Americans and shows that Nazi leaders actually fomented and supported violence. This is Arthur Gates in Nuremberg. I return you to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.
This is Arthur Gates in Nuremberg, Germany. American Associate Prosecutor Colonel Robert G. Story of Dallas, Texas, spent most of this afternoon demonstrating to the military tribunal that the government of Germany was completely dominated by the Nazi Party. He pointed out that this party, of whom all the defendants sitting down there in the courtroom were leading members, actually formed a cabinet, ministries, and councils so that they could give a semblance of legality to all their action. The point Story made was that the Reich's government was actually, or had actually become, the criminal instrument of the party. Among the interesting evidence produced was the fact that in 1937, the ban of party membership was lifted, and all members of the cabinet not in the party were given the golden badge of membership. At that time, only one prominent public official, Baron von Eltz, the minister of the post, had courage enough to decline membership. There is much whining now among these Germans that they could not escape party membership. In 1937, one man had courage and survived. Too many of the others probably were too willing to get into the select class. The prosecution today labeled Alfred Rosenberg the chief thief of the Nazi system. He was placed in charge of lifting valuable books, documents, and art objects all over Europe. Museums, private rooms, Masonic lodges, Rotary clubs were the sources of loot, so much so that it has taken 39 volumes to incompletely catalog all the art objects that have now been recovered. From France alone, some 26,984 railroad cars were lifted in a three-year period. The report shows practically 70,000 Jewish homes confiscated with that many sets of furnishings. An incomplete catalog shows over 10,000 paintings taken, including masterpieces by Rembrandt, Raphael, Bruegel, Rubens, Dürer, Reynolds, Romney, and others. There were practically 2,500 pieces of museum furniture, much of it from the collections of Louis XIV and XVI. There were practically 600 carpets and tapestries, thousands of antiques, oriental pieces, and handmade art objects. There was indication that Goering, Goebbels, and others quarreled among themselves as to who would obtain what, and that Goering actually had special agents out who brought into him hundreds of valuable pieces with which to decorate his apartments, castle, and offices. Never has there been such high-handed stealing. Not the Metropolitan Museum, the French Louvre, British Museum, or the Moscow Hermitage, if their collections were all combined, could compare in value with the loot these Nazis took. Today, these fellows down there were made to look like gangsters and thieves. They were practically robbed of their respectability. But late this afternoon, Hess still had the gumption to smile when he was being played up as the man through whose hands all legislation enacted in the Reich had to pass. This is Arthur Gaeth in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York. This is Arthur Gaeth in Nuremberg, Germany. There is increasing evidence of the Christmas spirit in this city, which once was the center of the gingerbread and metal toy industry of Europe, and which was famous for its Christmas market and popular festivals. It is not easy to catch the Christmas spirit among these ruins, for of the 121,000 living quarters which Nuremberg had in 1940, 68,000, or more than 50%, were destroyed. Of the literally hundreds of large and small toy manufacturing centers, employing some 18,000 people, only 24 are still in operation, and they work only part-time with about one-tenth of their former employees. The world's largest gingerbread factories of Heberlein and Metzger, which once employed up to 1,500 people in the Christmas season, today have no more than 130 employees. However, in the midst of all this, it is a wonder that they are operating at all. With the struggle for existence so severe, you wonder that people would think of Christmas and would make every effort to find tree decorations and presents, the spirit goes on. Yet some of the market squares are stacked with trees selling from 1 to 5 marks, not much more than in normal times. There are some wooden tree decorations available, and you can see people carrying home their trees and their handbags. We've had sunshine here the last 2 mornings, and men and women were out early trying to get into the few operating shops for what there is still left to buy. We watched more than 400 people line up before a gingerbread shop to stand for an hour or more for the little sack of these cakes they can buy with one of their bread ration coupons. The stationery stores and the tailors and dressmakers will probably supply most of the presents that are given, for there is little for sale. People are having clothes made over. There are long lists of exchanges offered in the want ad announcements with parents willing to exchange clothing for toys. I visited the famous toy manufacturing factory of Fleischmann Brothers this morning. About 50 people were employed there. They were still turning out the steam engines and electric trains for which they were known even in the United States. Those were the better trade toys that would sell for 400 to 500% their cost in America. They were made by unexcelled workmen. Today, the American Third Army is taking the full output. Motor-driven boats, electric trains, and steam engines. Not one of those toys will be available on the German market. Americans have had an opportunity to buy them in the PXs. Fleischmann Company made machine gun clips during the war, but stored its machines and could convert immediately. The raw materials were available. All the tin plate must now come from the French and British zones, and until now, no arrangements have been made. The famous Nuremberg gingerbread, which once was displayed in the leading department stores in New York City at Christmas time, is no more. Sugar, nuts, and egg whites are lacking. We had a taste of the pre-war quality, for a few cookies are being made as special Christmas gifts, but the spiced cakes now being put out are only a shadow of what once was. Yet people will stand in line for hours for them. At the famous Heberlein Metzger factory, 60% destroyed by bombs, We watch the women work the machines which knead the dough, which cut the cakes, which are then fed into the long electric stoves, only one of which is operating. It is extremely difficult to catch the Christmas spirit here, but that toys are still being made and cakes being baked among these ruins is evidence that somehow the symbolism of this festival has not died and that people are trying to keep it alive. This is Arthur Gaith in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York. This is Arthur Gaith in Nuremberg, Germany. Hess, Bormann, von Neurath, Rippentrop, Stauffel, Seisingquart, and Kaltenbrunner were faced with most serious charges today as Associate Prosecutor Major Warren Farr laid bare the different ways in which the SS was an unlawful political organization that should be declared criminal. There was only one happy man on the bench down below me as Farr ably piled up his evidence to show how the defendants were the leaders of this great gang of murderers. That was Hans Frank, uncrowned King of Poland, who was indicted in the original document as an SS general, which was a mistake. Frank, who already is burdened with so many serious charges out of his ruthless administration of the Polish government general, seemed visibly relieved, and he and Frick turned to each other with an attitude of gratification, for after Farr's presentation during the last 2 days, there was little doubt left of the murderous purposes of the SS. It operated the concentration camp. It was the spearhead in the persecution of the Jews. Millions of murders can be traced to its doors, and the tribunal could well rule that all of its members were part of the conspiracy and were to be brought before the court. When the tribunal recessed just a half hour ago for the Christmas holidays, Colonel Robert Story was presenting another important case against the SD, or the German Security Organization, and the Gestapo, or the state criminal police, whose horror record is almost inconceivable, what with gas chambers and death vans. In reviewing the results of the first month of these trials, I want to say that generally much more was accomplished than any of us expected. There's been an extensive amount of hard work done. Originally, the United States was going to prosecute the criminals it apprehended alone. Then it was decided to split up the case among the four great powers so that there had to be an exchange of evidence with the other nations taking over parts of the prosecution, somewhat scrambling some of the case. Whoever knows anything about joint operations of countries realizes that such action presents its difficulties, what with languages, tempers, and other problems involved. The American presentation will not be finished until after the recess. Much credit and praise is due the men who have been preparing the evidence. And the few so-called glaring weaknesses in the presentation of our case came to the surface when, for unknown reasons, attorneys have been allowed to present the evidence before the tribunal, evidence which they had not prepared themselves. When the tribunal reconvenes again on Wednesday, January 2nd, there will be a return to the American and then to the French and Russian presentations, after which the defense will have its day, which should be an extremely interesting one. This is Arthur Gaith in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.
And that, once again, was from December the 11th through the 20th of 1945, the Mutual Broadcasting System reporting from Nuremberg, Germany, on the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. Very, very dramatic reportage. On the live feed, which is right now, it's 1:35 on Friday afternoon, the 16th of December, 2011. On the live stream of this program, we are about to listen to something called We Hold These Truths. which was broadcast by all four nationwide networks on radio, being the Red Network of NBC, the Blue Network, which was quasi-independent at that time. It was in the process of being spun off from NBC. The process actually had started on the 7th of December, 1941, interestingly enough. The Columbia Broadcasting System, CBS, and the Mutual Broadcasting System, written by Norman Corwin. It was a celebration of the Bill of Rights on the 150th anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights, the addition of the Bill of Rights to the United States Constitution. The copy that we'll be listening to is downloadable at archive.org. Simply search for We Hold These Truths. You'll be able to find the MP3 eventually. And so that's what we're going to be listening to in just a moment. And I hope that you have liked what we had in today's program. And we'll join us next week, next Friday, providing that I don't wind up in the hospital again. I'm King David McKenzie. I greatly appreciate your having been here. I'll see you next week. Get out of the next 7 days alive. Remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.